Good morning, Tony. Good to be with you again.
And you. It's good to have you with us. Middle of the year, I think we've mentioned this sort of stuff before. It's never a great time for looking in the sky, but it's the best time for the actual clarity, isn't it?
Well, yes, and actually it's a strange thing, isn't it? Because just as you were saying, Tony, it never really gets really dark. Even at midnight, it's not really, really dark, is it? Which makes it difficult to see the stars. Not the planets, of course, because we can see those. But quite difficult to see the stars. So you've got to be out really, really late. But on the plus side, it's warm.
Oh, yeah.
Lovely and sunny. And you can be standing outside in just a T-shirt, which is...
you haven't got to stand there.
Which is just fantastic, isn't it? Yeah. Unlike the winter, where you sometimes feel you're a bit mad because you're standing out there with your coats on, freezing.
Get those gloves on and those roasted chestnuts going to keep your hands warm.
Exactly. But but also, though, on the plus side as well, in the summer, throughout the summer months, especially July, August, the views of the Milky Way arcing overhead are absolutely magical. It looks at its best, and of course it does, because where Earth is in its position in its orbit around the Sun, we're actually in those summer months looking towards the centre of our galaxy. And that's where, of course, it's really fascinating. It's where the big dust lanes are, you know, the huge multi-billions of stars that are there. And you can see it quite clearly arcing over your head. So any of your listeners, you just need to, you know, go outside at night, midnight onwards, really. So don't be working the next day. You need to just look up and give your eyes about 20 to 30 minutes to adjust to the darkness, semi-darkness, but you'll clearly see, if you just look up, there'll be an arc of light going from one horizon to the other. If you have a pair of binoculars, point them skyward, look at it, and then you'll clearly see that it will resolve into those countless hundreds of millions, billions of stars. And that is the centre. We're looking across towards the centre. I mean, for me here, the centre of the Milky Way galaxy is in the south. But you'll see constellations that you don't obviously see in the winter. And one of those is Sagittarius, looks like a teapot. And the spout of the teapot is actually pointing to the very centre of our galaxy. So that's fantastic in itself, isn't it?
Yeah, we get to teapots, but the thing that gets me with that is when you look up and you mention the galaxy, say watching you do a speech or a presentation a couple of months ago talking about the sheer vastness of it all, when you put that into perspective, what you're seeing above your head is, well, goodness knows how far away, and actually in the overall scheme of things is, well, it's no more than a pinprick of what's in the sky.
In reality, of course, we're orbiting our star, the Sun, and the Sun is about 27 light years away from the centre of our galaxy. So translated roughly, that's 27 times 6 trillion miles away from the centre of our galaxy. So, and that's still the cosmic doorstep, as we've shared so many times, Tony. Our galaxy is just one of countless trillions of galaxies out there, and we're... You know, our little planet Earth orbiting our tiny star that is nothing but a speck amongst the 200 to 400 other billion stars that are out there in just our galaxy, we tend to get a little bit lost. But when you look at the Milky Way arcing overhead at night, it's a lovely touch of perspective, and it really does make you appreciate where we are and how tiny we are.
Particularly good at the moment, say, looking up last night, you could see the galaxy very clearly. You could also see a banana-shaped moon, which was impressive, and not far away from it, to the right of it, was Venus.
Yes, absolutely beautiful. It's been looking stunning, hasn't it?
Yeah.
Tony, you mentioned that the moon is a crescent form, which it is, but also so is Venus. And on the 1st of July, it's going to be about 31% lit. So if you... I mean, it's quite difficult. It's going to get difficult to see because, of course, Venus has been looking beautiful lately, quite high up in the sky, but it's rapidly descending and it's actually setting. Well, in fact, by middle of the month, it's going to be setting just 3/4 of an hour after the Sun. So it's getting lower and lower, makes it harder to see. And in fact, most astronomers now, particularly if they have telescopes, they're going to go looking for Venus in the daytime, because, of course, you can find it if you've got a computerized scope, pump in the coordinates, and it'll put you onto Venus. And when you look at Venus in the daylight sky, obviously being aware of where the Sun is and be careful not to look at the Sun, you'll clearly see that it is a crescent, and it's a diminishing crescent, so it's going to get smaller and smaller, but it's still incredibly bright. And at the start of July, it's 30% lit, And it's that, it's reflecting the light from our sun, our star, and it's that that's making it so dazzlingly bright. And of course, you know, it's completely covered in a 40-mile thick layer of cloud, the entire planet, which makes it highly reflective, and that's why it is reflecting the light from our sun. It's absolutely stunning.
It was. Yeah, you had this moon that you probably more aptly call crescent-shaped. I call it banana-shaped, but I mean, you know, I suppose if it's a curved banana, it is. But anyway, crescent-shaped a moon, which is very bright. And so it was so apparent that what was next to it up in the night sky was a planet called Venus, because it was just so bright.
It was. And of course, the other thing to for your listeners to perhaps be aware of, I mean, you know, take the time. You know, we're always rushing around in our lives, aren't we? As we're always saying, Tony, we're always just so busy. We don't really take the time to stop, to be present, isn't it? Is the word that's often used these days. And it's so important, I think, especially in the summer, just to take that time, stop, look up at the night sky, look at the stars, and enjoy the moon. And one of the things about the moon at this time of the year is, although you can see that crescent, the banana shape illuminated, as you say, Tony, you can also see the rest of the moon sometimes because of a phenomenon called Earth shine. And the reason why that is, I mean, if you look at the moon, you'll see the crescent, but if you look to the left-hand side of it, even though it appears dark, look carefully and you'll see the craters and the mare of the, on, you know, the seas on the surface of the moon. And the reason why you can see that is because it is reflecting the light back from Earth. So you've got the sun hitting Earth and the light of our planet, our glorious blue marble, which in itself is so bright, the light that is bouncing from our planet is bouncing back up to the moon, and it is illuminating the moon. And isn't that incredible? Because the moon's, you know, about 250,000 miles away from us.
Which is very close. Yeah, but in real terms, it's not far, is it really? And the other thing with it is, of course, we see it from standing on Earth. There are a limited number of people who have had the privilege of standing on the moon and seeing the exact reverse, and also look out into deep space from the moon.
Indeed, wonderful.
with the sun. So they're going to actually, anybody that's done that, I'm guessing, would actually see how the sun is reflecting.
Yes, they would. And of course, you know, they've actually seen the Earth blocking out the sun and the moon blocking out the sun. It's pretty incredible.
The other thing that, of course, has been around for a while, Jupiter is also up there, looking, I think, pretty pretty right now, I think.
Yes, but only in the early morning hours. So for those of your listeners who are up at midnight, stay up, because approaching halfway through next month, July, Jupiter will be rising at about 1 o'clock in the morning. So it's a morning object and you need to be looking east, northeast, currently in the constellation of Aries. But the thing about Jupiter is it's going to get better and better in the coming months. It's going to get higher and higher up in the sky. The skies are going to get darker, of course, because we're coming into winter. And the higher it is, the more you can see, because it's above the sort of turbulence of our atmosphere. And because it's approaching its opposition, we're going to be able to see it almost all night as well. So Jupiter is one to have a look at in the morning if you're up and around really, really early. But it's going to get better and better.
Well, yeah, I mean, that as you said at the beginning of all of this, it's a spectacular time for looking up in the sky because of the clarity. But the problem is, of course, you don't get those hours of darkness, which, of course, as from I think today, I think the nights start to get shorter again, don't they?
Yes, and they are. We're beginning to notice it already, aren't we? It's just so quickly. I can't believe that we're halfway through the year.
It got dark at 10:10 last night, 5:00 tonight. Love it.
I just can't believe that we're halfway through the year. Crazy.
I know. It does make you wonder where the time goes. The other conversation, well, there's one thing I do want to talk to you about in a while, but noctilucent clouds. It's a word in itself. You might want to explain a little more about this.
Oh, well, these are, it's what we call the noctilucent cloud season. Noctilucent means night shining. And these are clouds that you can see in the July and August months. So obviously over the summer, and they're high altitude ice clouds. So they're up in the
atmosphere. Ice clouds?
So they're particles of ice, tiny, tiny things. They're only about 40 to 50 nanometers across, and a nanometer is about 1/1,000,000,000th of a meter in size. So they're just tiny, tiny ice particles. Sometimes, they're mostly seeded from fine dust, which results, you know, as a result of meteoroids sort of vaporizing in the atmosphere, and the ice settles on them. So they are tiny particles, but they create these clouds in the mesosphere, which is about 50 miles up. And these are always visible sort of 90 to 120 minutes after sunset, low above the northwest horizon. And the same thing applies in the morning. They're low above the northeast horizon. And they shine with sort of like an electric blue light. They're reflecting the light of the sun, because the sun never really sort of fully sets in astronomical terms. So because the sun isn't that low below the horizon at all, really, all night, that sunlight is reflecting on these tiny ice particles, and they create these beautiful shimmering effects across the night sky. So they're to look out for as well.
Yeah, that would be something. Is there a connection here in terms of what you actually see between a noctilucent cloud and the aurora borealis, which is dust clouds? So you've got ice clouds and you've got dust clouds. Is there a similarity?
Well, the aurora borealis really is something that's quite different, really. They're caused by the solar wind interacting with atoms in our upper atmosphere. And those atoms, well, we're protected by our magnetosphere, but sometimes our magnetosphere funnels that cosmic wind with those particles down, you know, into our upper atmosphere. And it's when those cosmic particles interact in our upper atmosphere, they excite those atoms. And what happens there is that the electrons in the atoms either leap up or leap down in their energy states. And when they do that, they release light. And depending on the atoms that they are, so they could be oxygen, they could be nitrogen, they could be hydrogen, dependent on those chemicals within the are those atoms, they will release different colours of light, and that is what we call the northern or the southern lights.
Oh,
so that's
okay.
The aurora borealis. So it's quite different, really.
Nicely explained. Me, I have to ask the question. Right, to the other subject that we stand outside at night and look up at the night sky, and mostly you're seeing stars in whatever level of darkness you can get. But just occasionally, you see this thing moving across the sky. It looks like a star, but it's not. It's actually a satellite. And there are many reasons for satellites being in space, and many of them to do with how we live our lives in this particular century with GPS and other things going on. They're quite important. But there's so many of them up there now, and so many of them are now redundant. And so the end result is that you have an awful lot of space junk floating around up there.
Yes, nicely put. And it is space junk, and it's a cautionary tale, isn't it? Because I was reading just the other day, actually, Tony, because there was a big space debate in Abu Dhabi. I think it was in December, at the end of December last year. And, you know, they raised the point that there are 70 space-capable nations. So there's 70 nations around the globe now that are capable of putting man-made artificial objects into space, i.e. satellites. There are space-mad billionaires out there also vying for the piece of space. And there's also a fast-growing private sector as well. And they're all vying for a stake in space. But, you know, what was surprising is that there are no laws or rules about space today, so it's verging on a bit of a free-for-all.
I was going to ask you about this. Is there no regulatory body in all of this when you say there are so many nations that are space-capable?
You're right, Tony. I mean, it's just incredible, isn't it? Because it raises the question, well, you know, who owns space? You know, who makes the laws? But our most important piece of, like, existing international legislation is the Outer Space Treaty, but that in itself is more than 50 years out of date, so which is incredible, isn't it? It's like a complete wilderness out there, and everybody's vying to get their piece. In a way, it's really quite worrying. And you're absolutely right, Tony, about the amount of junk that there is, because I remember in the lockdown COVID going outside, looking at the stars, and of course it was a fabulous time to be looking up because there were no aircraft, so the pollution was clear. I mean, it was just gone. I've never seen such clear skies.
They were one after the other, weren't they, going across the night sky?
Oh, goodness, yes. I looked up, I remember looking west and seeing 50 or 60 satellites in what we call a train of satellites.
Was that the Starlink train of Mr. Musk?
Yes, that's right, the Starlink train. And they were sort of flying across the sky, and I thought, my gosh, you know, what are they? Because I'd never seen so many, and this is ongoing. I mean, there are 6,000 satellites in orbit at the moment. We call low Earth orbit, so that's 1,200 miles or less above our planet. There's 6,000 in orbit, half of which are part of that Starlink network. But there's another 9,000 planned to join them. And there are even some reports suggesting that Starlink has requested authorization to launch another 42,000. And it's just going to get bigger, isn't it? Because there's more private space companies wanting to launch them over the next few years. So there were something like 800 active satellites in 2019, which isn't that long ago. 6,000 active satellites by December 22. And now that number is due to rise to something like 10,000 just by the end of this year. And that's going to, it's going to keep on increasing.
What do they all do? There's a limit to how much technology we actually need, because they're talking at the moment about the dangers of AI and all that sort of stuff, and I'm guessing we're straying into that territory somewhere. But what do all of these satellites do?
Well, a lot of it is for increasing the need for more widespread, more accessible broadband. But also a lot of them for studying climate change as well, apparently. And of course, I'm sure there are many others as well.
Well, that's a valid reason.
Fully aware of. Yes. But it's kind of littering the sky a little bit. You know, we need to clean up our act a bit. Mm. I mean, there's snaring them, I think, and netting them, you know, the debris that's up there. But, you know, a fragment of a spacecraft as small as 3 centimetres across could cause catastrophic damage to any other spacecraft that's up there. And of course, that it creates something that we call the Kessler effect, whereby one collision triggers like a runaway cascade of collisions. Each collision creates more debris, and that again increases the chance of a collision. That creates more debris, and so on, until our low Earth orbit is absolutely littered with space junk. And for astronomers, or especially radio astronomy, stargazers, anyone who's pointing their telescope skyward and wants to take images of those beautiful things out there, it's almost impossible to avoid these satellites, you know, passing in front of the collecting dishes and the scopes. You know, it's getting a bit crowded, and it's slightly a reflection of what's happening on this planet itself, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, there we get to a conversation that is possibly one for future conversations. But there we've actually run out of time. I hate to say it, because that's you're getting into a subject there which is quite a thing for me about the amount of things that are flying around in space. But I say we will return to that. But for now, Jane Green, thank you for talking to us, and we'll catch up with you in about a month's time, if that's okay.
Of course. Pleasure as always, Tony. Thank you.
Thank you, Jane.